I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Hadestown, the smash hit on Broadway, retells the tale of Orpheus and Eurydice, two star-crossed lovers who meet in the days when Greek gods roamed the earth and the heavens and the underworld. Or maybe it's the Depression era. Or maybe they're meeting today, when global politics, immigration, and climate change threaten an unsteady peace. This folk rock opera was created by Aeneas Mitchell, who grew up in Addison County. And although she wrote it in the early 2000s, imagining a 1930s Rust Belt setting, it's a remarkably current cautionary tale.
Why do we build the wall, my children, why do we build the wall? The wall keep us free, my children, how does the wall keep us free?
How does the wall keep us free? The wall keeps out the enemy, and we build the wall to keep us free. That's why we build the wall to keep us free.
Hades, the god of the underworld, explaining to his citizens why he works them to the bone. Hermes, the narrator, at the end of the story, explains, as he did at the beginning, that this is a sad song, a sad tale. But we sing it anyway, he says with conviction, because here's the thing, to know how it ends and still begin to sing it again, as if it might turn out this time. And it's a revelation, though it shouldn't be, when you sit in the audience. That's how this old story feels so new again. It's the story of human suffering and love and hubris and the abuse of power by the powerful and the discovery of power by the powerless. It's a story we humans keep telling, keep reliving. On the one hand, we never seem to learn. But look at it another way, and you could say we persist. We try again despite the odds, as if it might turn out this time. Like the tale it tells, the production has had multiple iterations, multiple lives, and Aeneas Mitchell's career has traveled with Hadestown and beyond. She'll be back in Vermont to perform solo work on October 11th and 12th, and she joins us now from New York. Aeneas, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Jane, thank you so much for having me.
You know, there are some in our audience who saw the original tour of Hadestown through Vermont, and maybe even a few who saw the very first staging of it at the Barry Labor Hall in 2006. Uh-huh. What kind of ambitions did you have for Hadestown back then when you were first imagining this work of art?
Yeah. Man, it's been such a long road with this show, and I feel like it was always kind of just one foot in front of the next. Certainly when we did that first version of the show at Barry Labor Hall, I couldn't have, in my wildest dreams, imagined that we would land on Broadway, you know, 13 years later. But at the very beginning, it was, I was living in Vermont. I was living in Montpelier, and it was a very exciting time in Montpelier. There was my husband, Noah, and some of his friends had started the Langdon Street Cafe, which was like... you know, it was almost like a sitcom where, like, you'd go to the cafe and everyone, you know, all the friends would be there. And there were a lot of creative minds in that cafe. And Ben Matchstick, the earliest director of the show, was hanging around the cafe. And Michael Chorney, who's still playing guitar in the show and is one of our two orchestrators. And then all of the friends from different bands around Vermont who played the roles of the characters were all kind of hanging out in that scene. And it was a very, it just felt like a sort of magical, fortuitous game time where people were like, sure, you want to do this folk opera? Let's make it happen on a shoestring and with no rehearsal time. So it was pretty charmed from the beginning.
But who writes a folk opera based on, you know, the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice? And I'll admit, when I was a kid, I learned the myth of Persephone, and I fell into it. I felt like I could walk into the pages of the book and be mm-hmm. in this myth. You know, she's in the underworld for 6 months and her mother is pining, and so she's allowed to come back, and that's why we have spring and summer, and this is a big part of Hadestown as well. But I couldn't have then taken the initiative to write a new version of it for myself. I mean, how engrossed and inhabiting that myth do you have to be to write your own folk opera that reimagines it?
Yeah, I mean, and certainly at the beginning, I didn't know how long, you know, how many years and how much work was going to go into it. But I'm not the first musician, obviously, to tackle this story. And I think it's appealing. It's been told so many times by way of music because there's this hero of the Orpheus character and this artist who believes that if he can make music beautiful enough, he can change the rules of the world. That was very compelling to me at 25 or whatever when I started working on it. And it turned out that the myth, not just the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice, but like you're saying, the Persephone and Hades relationship and story just kept kind of giving and unfolding in different ways over the years.
And so you thought, I can do this. I can write a new version of it. I can join that that long history and tradition of musical poets who've done this.
I can't say that it's ever as I'm not very forward thinking when it comes to writing. You know, it really at the beginning, I was just I was driving in my car and some lyrics came into my head that didn't end up in the show in any iteration. But the music that came with them ended up being the music of the song Wait For Me, which is kind of one of the big numbers in the show. And but the lyrics, the first lyrics that came in my head were, wait for me, I'm coming in my garters and pearls. With what melody did you barter me from the wicked underworld? And I was just driving in my car and the lines came in my head and I thought, it sounds like Eurydice. It sounds like that story. And and started to kind of pull on the thread and it unraveled a little bit. And then I got excited about the idea of telling a longer form story with music. Like I kind of come to songwriting as a writer. Words have always been like important to me. And in my upbringing growing up, my dad is a writer, a lot of books in the house. And I wanted to be a writer of some kind. And it turned out that songs was my way of doing that. And so I got excited about, you know, what would happen if I put a bunch of songs in a row and tried to tell a longer form story with them. Obviously I didn't know how long it would take or what the thing would turn into. And I'm lucky in a way, we're all lucky that none of us knew, like, no, there was no one there in Vermont in 2006 to say, like, you're not qualified to do that. Or, you know, you should have gone to grad school for that. And there was so much goodwill and gameness on the part of the artists who were coming together to make it happen that we just kind of thrust forward. And then there were, as you know, many other chapters of the story before we ended up with the show that we have running now.
And Anais David wrote us a note saying, please ask Anais to talk about the role Ani DiFranco played in her career. And Ani DiFranco is one of the stars of the original album of Hadestown that came out in 2010. And you produced albums on her Righteous Babe Records label. So what kind of role did she have?
Yeah. You know, Ani DiFranco has been huge for me in my musical life. And as a friend, you know, at this point, I feel close to her because I just read the book that she wrote, which came out this past year and was really, really moved by it. But I was, you know, Ani DiFranco was one of the first songwriters that I fell in love with. I came to on my own, you know, not by way of my parents or my friends. And I fell in love with her music. And I would drive, you know, this was before you could just stream the music online or whatever. I would drive to Burlington, kind of a long drive, to like get the new album when it came out and then listen to it and wish that I had written every song and, you know, be totally obsessed with it. And so I might not have picked up the guitar if it weren't for her. Like, some of the first few songs I learned how to play on the guitar were Ani DiFranco songs. And then pretty early on in my songwriter career, I had put out one record and I was just touring around doing whatever gigs I could possibly get. And I played a show in Buffalo, New York, that was put together by the childhood guitar teacher of Ani DiFranco, and who was a promoter of shows. And he, unbeknownst to me, invited her out to the gig, and she saw the set, and then offered me a record deal on her record label, Righteous Babe Records, and I immediately said yes, and got to do like some touring with her at a pretty young age, probably before I was ready even for such an opportunity. But then, so I made one record. You talked about it in the introduction, called The Brightness, that was a songwriter album and was produced by Michael Chorney, who I mentioned before, and that came out on the label. And then the next thing I was working on was Hadestown, and Ani and her label got a hold of like a bootleg recording of what we were doing at the Barry Labor Hall and for Jen's Opera House, and she said, I can help you make this record.
Wait, she had to get a bootleg recording? You didn't just say, here's a recording for you?
Oh no, I mean, I'm sure I sent it to her, but I mean, we didn't go in the studio at that point and lay anything down. It would have been just like a field recording from one of the shows. But she said that, you know, her label could help to make it. And also she said she'd love to sing one of the roles of the characters. And she was the first of the guest singers to commit to the project. And she didn't even really know what she was getting into at the time. So it was a vote of confidence, and it put the wind in the sails of the project of making that studio record, which took a few years and came out in 2010. And then there was a phase of Hadestown that was really just kind of music phase, concert phase, where the album came out and then we toured around putting together little ensembles of singers that would sing the roles of the characters. There was no staging or costumes or props or anything. It was just almost like a radio novella version of the show.
Yeah, it must have been quite different to stage that kind of performance where you're sort of singing, just singing, not really doing it as a full-fledged opera, versus spending, what, a couple of years getting it ready to stage it on Broadway. And of course, it was off-Broadway. It was in Canada. It was in London as well. So you've had many iterations of this. But, you know, it's a very different kind of process, I would imagine.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, in the concert era, it was like, it was always too many people on a tiny stage, you know, like more people on stage than in the audience. Or we played rooms like Club Passim in Boston, you know, or McCabe's Guitar Shop in Santa Monica. And it was just like a silly amount of people. We had, you know, Michael Chorney and his little 6-piece band and then 7 or so singers up there. So it was always, but you know, it was a really, it was an amazing and valuable way to connect with other artists. We had kind of without fail a really good time with everyone that we put on that show with. And there aren't a lot of opportunities. You know, sometimes you run into other songwriters at a festival or a conference or something, but it always is like ships in the night, you know, or you see, oh, they're playing that room. I played there, you know, 2 weeks ago. But to actually have a project to work on with people, it was really gratifying.
Again, we're talking with Anais Mitchell, and we're talking about Hadestown. We're talking about her creative process, and we'll be talking about other things she's working on. She's going on tour, actually just about to go on tour as we speak. And if you have a question for her, our number is 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.org. You know, Anais, we played Build a Wall at the very beginning, and it's so current. I mean, just the very title of it and you know, in a lot of the story, you can see these notes and these things that are happening now. There's a lot of sort of nods to immigration. There's thoughts about climate change, who's in and who's out, who gets to belong. And it feels so current. You must not have known that, obviously, what was coming when you first wrote it. But did it almost feel too on the nose as you're staging it for Broadway, like in 2017 and 2018? Like, oh, man, you know, here's a president who wants to build a wall, and we have a song. You know, why do we build the wall? To keep people out. So, I mean, did that connection feel good or not good?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, certainly in the last few years, the timing has been really crazy because we put the show up off Broadway at the New York Theater Workshop in the East Village in 2016. And if I'm right, yeah, this was during the campaign for the presidency. And there's those rallies were happening where, you know, it was like it was sort of a back and forth call and response about like, who's going to build the wall? Like, who's going to pay for it?
Yeah.
It felt so similar to what was happening on stage. It was really uncanny. And I thought, as I'm sure a lot of us did, that it was a campaign thing that was going to disappear. So the fact that it's still in the news it is a surprise. And there was a moment where it was like, well, should we be tailoring this show, you know, with this uncanny resemblance, should we be tailoring this show more toward the current political moment? And I really felt, and I mean, I think so did Rachel and so did all of us, feel like, no, that's not our job. Like what we're working on here is a myth, and it's an ancient story that will be perennially relevant. And it's deeper to work with the, you know, the archetypes than to try to speak to the moment. Like it's deeper than the guy who's in power and has the microphone now. This is something that's it's longer and older and deeper than this moment.
It's pretty remarkable, yeah, though, to sit in the audience and on Broadway and be like, oh my God, this is such an ancient story, and yet it also is so modern and so current.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And that's kind of what I was talking about with, like, the way the myth has kept on giving, that things just kept unfolding in a way that made them feel fresh, which is good, to you know, because I worked on it for so long that it needed to have some surprises, different moments. But, yeah, when I first wrote that song, and, I'm the first one to say I'm like a very slow songwriter. It takes me forever and ever to – usually there's a spark of inspiration and then there's like months, if not years, of me trying to bring something to fruition or to like a place where it feels ready to be of use to somebody else. But that song, While We Build the Wall, I wrote that all in one sitting. And it happened so quickly that I almost didn't know what it was or what, you know, was it good or what, you know, what did it mean? And I started to play it in my songwriter shows, and it was very quickly like the one that people wanted to hear every time. And I didn't know, obviously, you know, how relevant it would become. But when I first wrote it, I was thinking about climate change. You know, these were trends that obviously existed back then. This was in the early 2000s, and it just my brain sort of taking them to their logical, terrifying conclusion and thinking, you know, what if there's more and more storms? What if there's more and more refugees? There's, you know, desperate people knocking at the door of the place of relative wealth and security. And who among us in that place of relative wealth and security is not going to be afraid and kind of want to be behind a wall?
Mm.
So that's that, you know, those thoughts were going on back then. And obviously same trends have intensified now. And the climate change stuff really started to come into focus in the show because the characters of Hades and Persephone, I was sort of like kept chipping away at them and deepening them. And there is this very unusual, uneasy marriage between the king of industry, you know, and Hades is, even in the Greek stuff, in the ancient stuff, sometimes called the wealthy one. And there's so much about the, you know, the innards of the earth, the gold and silver and the treasures of the earth and the oil and coal that we have made our wealth on that come from underground. And then Persephone, who's the queen of the seasons and the natural world and is responsible for the balance of the world. And the fact that these two are married and could have this troubled marriage and that be a part of the storytelling, it felt like it brought all of that climate stuff really more to the fore and more into focus.
But if all you got is your own two legs, just be glad you got them.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're joined from New York by Anais Mitchell, who grew up in Addison County, went to Middlebury College, lived in other parts of Vermont before lighting out for New York, where she's the much-celebrated force behind the Hadestown production, now playing on Broadway. Mitchell wrote the music, lyrics, and book. Rachel Chavkin helped develop and directed the production. This is a song called Young Man in America from her 2012 album by the same name.
Hungry, running every which way.
Anais, I've always loved that song, "Young Man in America." Just again, your songwriting and your music has an ability to sound both old and new, sort of fresh and traditional at the same time. Is that something that you cultivate, that juxtaposition?
Thank you so much. It's interesting. I was working on that album, "Young Man in America," around the same time that I was working on this collection of like reimagined traditional ballads from across the pond with my friend Jefferson Hamer, which was a record called Child Ballads. And for a while, the two albums were like neck and neck, and we didn't know which one was going to come out first. But I know for sure that a lot of those young man songs were like really influenced by those older, those ancient ballads. And there's language in that song that comes straight out of those ballads, like, you know, black and roving eye. I think we just heard that line. That's mm-hmm. a very traditional ballad song line. I've always leaned in this direction as I've kind of gotten older as a songwriter. But I love the intersection of like what feels really real and true emotionally for me, and also what feels like it's part of something bigger, older, more epic. If it can be both things, that's my happy place.
It sounds like that's part of what you're doing in one of your new projects, a collaboration called Bonnie Light Horseman, too. It's being called a folk supergroup, and it also includes Josh Kaufman, who people might know from The National, and Eric D. Johnson from Fruit Bats. Is this sort of a meeting of the minds on that idea of, you know, going back in time and bringing back this language and these words and this way of talking in a more modern era?
Yeah, something like that. You know, we resist that word, that name, supergroup, because it always sounds like a vanity project. You know what I mean? and for us, I think we'd like people to listen to it as its own project and not like, oh, there's the Fruit Bats guy, you
right?
Know? But it's it's kind of been the one creative thing, one creative pan that I could keep in the fire while I was also working on Hadestown the last couple of years. And I met Josh, who also lives in Brooklyn, and he introduced me to Eric, who I've been a fan of for a few years. And we all kind of in different ways have come to traditional music, loving it and wanting to work in it and feeling inspired by it. And this has been a very like intuitive project. We wanted to work on old songs, but not in like a research project type of way. You know, I didn't want to get like too geeky about it and just like really go for the feelings and the wide openness of how some of that music can feel. It's all, for me, it's all an open D tuning on the guitar, which I never have played in before, but it's so great. It feels just like water flowing. And there's something about that openness, the droniness, and the way that the voices can play around over it and the space. So that's kind of what we're up to. And we're putting out a record at the beginning of next year, which is titled after our band. So it's called Bonnie Light Horseman.
Good. I was wondering when that record was coming out. You played at the Newport Folk Festival and the first single is out and there's purportedly a record. So the beginning of next year, is that when it's out?
It's real. There's really a record. we're very excited about it. I think January is the plan.
Let's go to some calls. Samantha's calling in from Charlotte. Hi, Samantha.
Oh, hi, Anais. I just wanted to thank you so much for just continuing what you're doing. I moved to Vermont from New York City 20 years ago and started to hear you
awesome.
immediately, and it has been awesome. And my daughters were like 5 and 6 at that. Like, we started to listen to you, your original Hadestown album that we still listen to. And I can't say enough about what you've meant to us. But my comment is that I know the Why We Build the Wall song gets rightfully, I think, so much attention right now. But I actually wanted to say that I think what's really important, my girls and I saw the Broadway performance twice already. And we both times I felt what was so powerful is your ability to bring the earth to New York City in the center of this huge, just world of buildings and cement. You bring so much of like trees and rivers and flowers, and unapologetically give this other world to this as the solution to, Hades town, which is, a perfect metaphor for today. And I know that, I see why there's so much, gravitation toward the wall and how timely it is, but I just can't say enough about how beautiful it is to hear you, to know that the whole audience sitting there is getting something that in Vermont we really take for granted. Like, I'm looking at a field of sunflowers right now as I talk to you, and that isn't something I grew up with at all. And I think it's important to solving so much of the problems of today, the climate for sure, but politically even. I think you just bring humanity so closely tied in your story to the earth.
So Anais, do you see that in the production too, what Samantha's talking about?
Oh, man, I love that you just said that, Samantha. You know, it's funny because, yeah, a lot of those songs that are the kind of Orpheus nature songs, I wrote them in Vermont. And, the wedding song and, like, promises and all that invocation of the natural world, which felt really right for the Orpheus character, because in the mythology, he's able with his music to charm all living and even inanimate things like plants and animals.
Or the rocks and walls.
And rivers. Yeah, exactly. There is something about the invocation of a word, even right in this day and age, and I feel you, and I miss the natural world because I live, in Brooklyn now. So there's this songwriter in Canada. Do you know Farron? The music of Farron.
Mm-hmm.
I was sort of raised on her records, and she's a very important kind of poet songwriter to me growing up. And I got to open up for her one time in Montreal, and she sort of took me aside, like, had seen my set and maybe wanted to, like, connect with me as a kind of, like, in a mentor type of way. And she was like, yeah, you should understand that when you say a word, you summon a spirit. If you say the word door, you summon the spirit of the door. And it's like, it's very woo-woo, but there is something about it, right, that Orpheus can go to the depths of the earth and then invoke this natural imagery, and it has an effect on people. So I love that you said that, and I think you're right. We do need to bring ourselves more into contact with the world that is not human made.
The day I saw Hadestown on Broadway, I have to say, it was during the heat wave. So it was felt like Hades in New York City. It was like 100 degrees and light was bouncing off the buildings and pounding onto the pavement. So you could see that juxtaposition that Samantha's talking about with the New York City versus the natural world. We're talking to Anais Mitchell. If you have a question, a couple minutes left, 1-800-639-2211. Gavi's calling in from Dummerston. Hi, Gavi.
Hi. Hi, Jane. Hi, Anais. I'm glad to have you get to talk to you. I'm the theater director at the Putney School, and I'm really looking forward to seeing you at Next Stage. And I was lucky enough to see Hadestown in London. And my question is that as different people have taken on the roles in the show, especially Orpheus and Eurydice, what have different actors and musicians brought to the roles, and how have those roles changed with the different people you've worked with?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. I've learned so much from every single actor that we've worked with off Broadway, in Canada, in London, and on Broadway. And I hope you'll go see the show, in light of your question, I hope you see the Broadway version, because one of the main major changes between London and Broadway has to do with the Orpheus character. I hate it when people try to compare the different actors that have taken the roles, partly because they're all like stunning unicorns, but also the writing, you know, has had so much to do with it, and the characters have evolved. Like the role of Orpheus now is quite different than it was off Broadway or even in London, and the same thing is true of Eurydice. I think, you know, every actor we've worked with has brought their innate self, and we really have sought out actors that are kind of that their DNA somehow, their spiritual, their spirit is quite close to the character that we're seeking, and so I've learned as much from their interpretation of a character as I'm sure that they learned from the evolving script. But I just wanted to tell you about the Orpheus character, because he was one of the trickiest ones to write for some reason. Like all of the other characters in the show are sort of jaded, kind of ruined in some way. You know, Hades, Persephone, Hermes, even Eurydice, all the fates, they're all, they've been around. There's like a world weariness to them, which is a lot easier for us to buy as an audience. And the tricky thing about Orpheus is he's always has had to be this optimist, you know, this dreamer, this believer. And it's hard to take that kind of a character seriously. And I think part of the problem for a long time was that he was sort of, because he's this character that goes to do the impossible thing, goes to the underworld to do this impossible thing, has this insane belief in, you know, in himself and the power of his music, and then ultimately is undone by doubt at the end. His confidence, sort of his hopefulness, always felt like a really important part of his character. And the way that that came across, even right up to London, I think, was a kind of cockiness. Like, you know, he just comes across kind of like, yeah, like a cocky guy. And that wasn't helping. And it wasn't ever what I had in mind for Orpheus. And so we made some changes. I did a lot of rewriting. And then there was obviously some changes in the direction and costume and things for Broadway. We're really like making Orpheus more of an innocent, that he's a pure artist who is not quite of this world, you know, and he can see, he has powers, he can see the way that the world could be, but he's not that good at living in the world that actually is, you know. He's not equipped in the same way that a character like Eurydice, who's really been through a lot, seen a lot, is. And him, sort of his hopefulness coming from a place of naivety rather than cockiness, felt like it really changed the alchemy of who that character is and what the relationship is with Eurydice, and also what it's like for that character to go up against the king of the underworld.
Hmm. That's so interesting. You know, it's also interesting that of the original, you know, all the way back, the original cast, you still have Michael Cherny, who's playing in the house band on Broadway, and he's been involved in, yes, this from the start. And I found that really intriguing, but also wondered for you, I mean, you know, you've been so involved in this, and now you might be making dinner or going out on tour on a night that, you know, Michael Cherny's in the band and this production is going up on Broadway. And I wonder how that, mm-hmm, feels to you to not be so intimately involved.
Mm-hmm. I know. It's really, well, first of all, just mad props to Michael for sticking with the project for so long. he orchestrated the very first songs that ever were written for the show in 2006, and he has continued to do so. And as the show has evolved in different ways, continued to be part of it and is still playing most nights, in the band, on stage. And yeah, for me, it's weird. You know, when we're working on a production, any of them, but especially Broadway, you know, I'm essentially like living at the theater, just like drinking dozens of cups of coffee and like trying to rewrite things, you know, from day to day based on the feedback. And, it's a very intense, I feel like I've moved into that theater. And then the moment that the show is locked and it opens, I suddenly feel like a stranger there. You know, I'm going to go see the show this weekend, but I rarely go. And when I do, I'm like, is this okay? Do I belong here? Can I go backstage? Like, I'm not sure what my job is anymore. But it's amazing. I mean, it does really feel like the piece is way bigger than me and bigger than any of us who have worked on it over the years. Like, it's I started to feel that watching the show on Broadway and then seeing the crowd that would come at the end of the show to stand at the stage door and meet the actors. And some of them were like dressed up as characters from our show. And I will never understand, you know, what the relationship is of that young person to this show. It's not for me to say, you know. It's like the show is its own animal and it has its own momentum. And it's so it's pretty remarkable to get to stand back and see it just doing its thing.
So we got like 20 seconds, but you're doing solo stuff, some Hadestown stuff. You're two sold out shows in Vermont, but people may be able to catch you elsewhere on tour.
Yeah, exactly. And just a quick thing. I'm going to be on October 11th, I think, I'm playing in Burlington. And then after that show, I'm going to run over to my friend Miriam Bernardo's album release show. And Miriam was the original Persephone in the Vermont version of Hadestown. And she's like this legendary Vermont singer who has finally made a record of her own. And she had a bunch of Vermont songwriters write songs for it. And I wrote one of them. So if you're looking for something to do later in the evening on October 11th, go and check her out. 9 p.m., 10 p.m. at the Double E Lounge.
That's Anais Mitchell. She's performing in Vermont on October 11th and 12th. Both shows are sold out, one in Burlington and one in Putney. But we'll put details up for the rest of her tour and for that at vpr.org. Anais, thank you so much for talking with us, and good luck.
Thank you so much, Jane.